We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. We have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft cock.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Hello again, Higher Side Chatters. Wow, it has been a while since I've done one of these. And honestly, it's for a couple of reasons. Mainly because the holiday season and my job is just crazy demanding. And as much as I hate it, I fucking need it. I was also planning a special where I went on an overnight ghost hunt with the San Diego Paranormal Research Group. Me and my special lady went there, but nothing really happened. I thought it was pretty boring. I decided not to do that one because I could either make fun of the research team to make it interesting, which I did not want to do, or I could make it seem like something happened that didn't, and then I'd be like the paranormal shows on television, which is not the goal. I'm trying to take an honest look, and if nothing happens, then fucking nothing happens. So here we are. I wanted to take a second to announce a couple changes to THC. First of all, I'm going to try really hard to have a show up every week, every Sunday specifically. So we will have a solid schedule. It's something that the show really needs, and it's been great to get so much support with such a sporadic schedule, but we got to get on track. We're not going to hit that next level. I'm going to be posting more news as well. More importantly, I'm going to be introducing some new co-hosts and bloggers to the site. Very thankful and excited for that anybody wants to be contributing there and sees it as a positive thing and worth their while. And it's looking like once we get some of the details worked out, we're going to have some type of content on the website pretty much every day. We're going to kick this bitch up a notch. And thanks so much for all the support and for listening, sharing, and donating to the show. Thanks for buying my t-shirts at conspiracies.net to keep things going. It's really been awesome. And I want to take it to the next level, make it a little more awesome. So be on the lookout for some new personalities at THC. I think there's going to be some awesome additions. So please keep helping the show grow, and I'll keep trying to bring you interesting guests and topics. Today, my friends, is no different, so I'm going to stop wasting your time. Here's episode 40, Disneyland's Hidden Magic with Walter Bosley. Enjoy. Folks, I'm willing to bet you grew up just as mesmerized and enchanted by the fantasy and magic of the world of Disney as I did. It would be very hard to grow up in this country and not have heard the name Walt Disney. Yes, it seems Disney is as American as apple pie and false flag attacks. But what if those words mesmerized and enchanted were once more than just the empty marketing buzzwords they are today? What if the Disney magic was once quite literally magic? Well, today's guest suggests just such a hypothesis in his book Latitude 33, The Key to the Kingdom, and his name is Walter Bosley. Walter has walked an interesting path, covering everything from 2 decades working in high-level private security and counter-espionage, to founding the publishing company Lost Continent Library, and more recently, the production house No Budget Cinema. He's been an FBI specialist, a filmmaker, an author, and the spoonful of sugar that helps medicine go down. Walter Bosley, how the hell are you?
Doing pretty good today, Greg. How about you?
Kuna fucking matata, man. I'm excellent. I'm very happy that Adam Gorightly recommended I read Latitude 33 because I really loved it, and thanks for coming on to discuss it with me.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate any opportunity to talk about the work.
Yeah, man. Well, to kick it off, in the intro I talked about the Disney magic, and your book is called Latitude 33. I'm sure the connection isn't immediately apparent for most people, so let me have you tell them what we're talking about here, and we'll get into some of the details. Why Latitude 33? What's the connection?
Well, that's because Disneyland is located physically at the north latitude of 33, specifically 33, I believe, 0.1881. And this is a latitude that, as the book points out, where a lot of interesting things exist or have occurred. Mm-hmm. There's a zone between 30 and 40 degrees latitude north that, you know, you'll find a lot of interesting things in places. But 33 specifically has a few, you know, interesting associations. Dallas, of course, the site of the JFK assassination, mm-hmm. is roughly there at latitude 33. And if you're familiar with the S.A. King Kill 33, you'll know all about the esoteric associations with that assassination. On a lighter note, there's interesting architectural things, and just, you know, the book says it's been a while since I wrote that book, a few years, so if I'm rusty on the smaller details, you'll hear me refer to the book.
Well, I mean, I've heard that the Bermuda Triangle touches on that latitude.
Yeah.
Roswell touches on that latitude.
Yes.
So there are some interesting things there. I mean, I live in San Diego. A lot of the book is about Southern California, of course, mm-hmm. as it is about Disneyland. And I live right around the corner. The closest bar to my house is actually called Latitudes, and it's the 32nd degree, which is kind of close. But now, what do people need to know about the idea of unified fields and the energy grid? What causes an attraction to this parallel? I mean, it is unified fields and the idea of ley lines, but what do they need to know about it before we get into their use at Disneyland?
Well, I would say that the reason that people and builders and such are drawn to this zone, this latitude, is because it's a very practical consideration. You find nice, evenly temperate zones there that are good for agriculture, are very, you know, more pleasant living conditions, that kind of thing. So that's a very practical, common sense reason for people to be drawn there. But mm-hmm. of course, the energy that is there contributes to this state. Specifically, and there's energy all over the planet, but because of the fact that, you know, the warmer you get, people tend to associate that with comfort. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's the really hot zones where that's not comfortable, and the latitude of 33 tends to be in the zone that's, you know, comfortably between the colder and the hotter zones. So,
yeah.
So it's a common sense thing. I'm assuming your listeners, you know, are used to the concept of the planetary grid.
Right.
So, you know, basically it's the grid of energy that runs physically through the planet, which I like to identify with telluric current, popularly called ley lines.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that engineers are aware of, and different engineers take advantage of it in different ways.
Mm-hmm. This is, it seems like it's been known about for a long time. A lot of people bring up the idea of ley lines and energy grids when talking about, like, lost knowledge or ancient technologies. Do you think there was a time when these nodes on the grid were harnessed more regularly? Like, aren't a lot of ruins and structures on these cross sections?
Yes, you do find ancient ruins, ancient structures, conspicuously located where these energy lines and energy nodes are. So it strongly suggests that this was a much more commonly known phenomenon, physical phenomenon, and used in ways a little more overtly than today. As the book goes into it, I believe, if I recall right, that book, because my book right after it gets into it a little more.
Mm-hmm.
the builders of the telegraphy system, the old telegraph system of the Old West, and you know, the 19th century thing, they were very much aware of this, and they actually tapped systems of telegraphy into this this ground energy, because it's an ELF, an extremely low frequency current. Mm-hmm. And it would boost, you know, they would post their telephone, their telegraph lines along these lines where, you know, and they had their methods of knowing where they were at, finding where they were at. But you also find where engineers place hospitals and airports and military bases and radio stations, mm-hmm. because they're aware that this natural telluric current can boost the various processes involved in those types of structures and institutions is mm-hmm. the word I'm looking at. It assists in healing. It boosts communication. You know, and all these things. Railroad lines also have a tendency to be built along these lines. The physical railroad tracks and such.
And it is odd that it does seem part of that hidden knowledge, you know, in the conspiracy realm.
My gentleman who does the geomorphology, so to speak, if that's what we call it, what he does, he considers it an open secret amongst engineers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just something that the public finds hocus pocus because they're generally not aware of it, and then when they find out about it, it just sounds like magic, which, you know, Arthur C. Clarke said any sufficiently advanced technology would seem like magic, and that's what this is.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned military bases was actually my next question, because you've worked with the military and government for a long time, and I've heard it suggested mm-hmm. that, you know, the U.S. places their bases on this grid, and some of the wilder stories are that they do this so they can control and lock down the occasional multidimensional portal that opens up along these lines on the Earth. Have you heard of that at all? What are your thoughts on that?
I've heard of it, and my opinion is if anybody's going to have any kind of control to access these things, it makes sense that it would be, you know, that the military would be involved in that. So, sure, I mean, that makes logical sense. Mm-hmm. Whether we can prove that or not is a different issue, but that does make logical sense to me that they would and they do.
I've heard that idea used to explain the presence of Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, you know, flying saucers and ghosts. I know you're familiar with Nick Redfern. I just had him on recently. His most recent book is The World's Weirdest Places. It's kind of along the same lines, is that there are weird places that attract strange phenomenon.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with you. There's something to that.
Well, where would you suggest, because I love the paranormal, I love the conspiracy world and all the mystery around it, but I've never had much of a personal experience. And if there were a place to go to, you know, increase the chances of that, I mean, would you have a suggestion?
Oh, yeah, there's any number. But my first question would be, do you think you are truly prepared for it? Because I'll tell you, mm-hmm. I don't like to call it a Pandora's box.
Right.
But, you know, it's similar in idea, because once you walk through or open certain doorways, there's really no turning it off 100%. Mm-hmm. So you have to really think about that. These are the kinds of things that can separate you from others in the day-to-day experience of life in reality. You know, not that things are going to be floating around your head constantly. You know, the presence is most of the time a lot more subtle than that, but it does change your perspective on what reality is. It changes your values in some cases, and this has not happened to me, but it can potentially, you know, it can end friendships, it can affect, mm-hmm. you know, close relationships, that kind of thing. You know, it has affected mine to the extent of I know who amongst my friends and family that I can talk about certain things and who I cannot.
Right.
Because they can't handle certain things. or, you know, they just don't want to accept it. So you have to be prepared. You have to consider all of that before you would go looking for these things. At times it'll be a handful, but you're in the San Diego area, you said. Where specifically?
Pacific Beach.
Oh, you're at PB, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would recommend spending time. Do you spend much time in Balboa Park?
You know, I've been there, yeah. I know Balboa Park pretty well.
Spend more time there.
Yeah.
And also pay a visit to the Cabrillo Monument on Point Loma whenever you get a chance.
Yeah, there's some anomalous stories going on over there.
My current research and some of the stuff I talk about in my book after Latitude 33, Empire of the Wheel, gets into that a little bit. But since you're there, and I would recommend spending more time in Balboa Park, you know, go over there and pay the occasional visit to the Cabrillo Monument. You're not going to see anything overt, but these are places where the energy flows very strongly. And this is one of those things where it's essentially the more exposure you get, the more exposure you get,
mm-hmm.
if you catch my meaning. And it takes a little time for things to, I guess I'll use the word manifest.
Right.
That's really the best word.
You know, I would say I'm pretty ready for an experience. I mean, of course, you know, you can say that
uh-huh.
as many times as you want.
Yes, you
can. I've had some strange experiences with psychedelics. You know, I've tried to induce it that way.
You know what? I'm not saying you're wasting your time when you do that, but that's artificial.
You think so?
Oh yeah, it's artificial.
Have you had a serious psychedelic experience?
No, I've never needed to. From the time I was a young kid and the time I was a teenager when I had an enlightenment experience, I've never needed, well, let me put it this way. I've never needed substances to have a psychedelic experience.
And that's a fair point. And I have friends like that as well. And I did question the validity of the experience before I had it. But post-experience, I feel like it's kind of trying to explain the color green to a blind man. You know, it's like, it is pretty pretty realistic. I would equate it to, you know, I have friends who meditate and wade into the waters. And a good
mm-hmm.
psychedelic trip is like diving off the high dive. But to get back to the book, Latitude 33, the idea of ley lines and the energy, another thing that happened recently, right before I started reading your book, I was watching an alternative documentary on the Nazis and their sort of fringe science, you know, involving earth harmonics and stuff like that. And in your book, you touch on that a bit too, mainly on the Nazi bell. What can you tell people about the stories of the bell?
Well, I can't tell it as good as Igor Kukowski or Joseph Farrell, but the basics are that starting as early as the 1920s, the Nazi scientists, the German scientists during that era, were beginning to work on the principles of this device that was known as the bell, and they went into it looking for alternative propulsion systems for aircraft and potentially spacecraft. And what they discovered was a much more comprehensive technological potential or technology, mm-hmm. say. And it was actually, my understanding is that it was based on, you know, the ancient Vimana technology, essentially, or they were messing with the same things,
mm-hmm.
in which it was a rotating device. One part fit inside the other, and it counter-rotated, and there was a layer of a special mercury compound, liquid, that was pumped in between the two layers, and the combination of the counter-rotation and this mercury created fields, and these fields affected the physical physical objects on the atomic
mm-hmm.
level. It caused great destruction. It was responsible for the deaths of technicians, but it also had an effect on time-space. And so you can imagine all the theories, you know, abound as to what this thing was and could do. Some people say it explains, you know, the modern flying saucer era. Others say, you know, it was a time machine, and it could very well have been both. And like I said, Mr. Kwiatkowski and, of course, Joseph Farrell, they write about it in greater detail and do greater justice to it than I do. But it's along the lines of these ancient technologies that have been lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like this knowledge and use of this energy isn't really that rare. It's just a bit underground. And, you know, it was at this point in my thought process when I was speculating based on the persistent rumor that Walt Disney was a 33-degree Mason, that it might be called the 33-degree because that's when they present you with the hidden knowledge of ley lines and the power of the 33rd degree. But you've looked into the idea that Walt was a Mason, and sadly it seems to have no basis, despite a convenient similarity to the number 33, right?
Yeah, and Walt Disney being a Mason is a persistent rumor that, you know, I personally try to put to rest because being a Mason myself, you know, I contacted...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'm just a third degree Blue Lodge Mason, as they call it. And, you know, I said, well, heck, that's easy. Let's call some of the, you know, the state lodges, whatever. And I checked two or three Masonic sources. They came back and said, no, Walt Disney was never a Mason, never raised in a lodge, nothing. He had been involved in De Molay when he was a teenager. Well, De Molay, of course, is it's the youth organization of Freemasonry, but a lot of kids, a lot of young men were in De Molay that never really went on to become Masons. It was just kind of like being in, you know, like if Kiwanis, I think they have something called the Key Club for high school age and stuff. You know, a lot of these various fraternal orders that are, you know, business and social orders and stuff, they have these. And, you know, they just do good deeds for the public when they're kids, that kind of thing. And Disney was that. But he never went on to be a Freemason. And yet that rumor persists based on nothing more than people keep saying it. So I try to do my part to point out.
Now, let me ask you, is it easy to find out, like, who, if 33rd degree is the highest level, or at least the highest public level, to my understanding, is it easy to find out who's on that list?
Well, if you have a lodge, you know, a Scottish Rite lodge, because the degree's that high, or the Scottish Rite, if they're willing to, you know, if you're asking about a famous person... Yeah, I see where if you call them and there's an individual who, you know, you're asking about, they're very likely to tell you, oh, yes, absolutely, member of this lodge, you know, it achieved the 32nd degree and then went on to get 30. Not a whole lot of people become 33rd degree. It's often a posthumous thing.
Are these societies, the Mason Society, Scottish Rite, are these the things, like, do you think that they hold some hidden knowledge that they release to you as you go up the ranks? Or, you know, what is the point of going from a 32nd to 33rd degree?
Well, you got to remember, these organizations have a twofold existence. Mm-hmm. Primarily, they are... philanthropic organizations. It's a way for, you know, businessmen and or civic leaders to get together and get to know each other, socialize and network. But as a group, they sincerely and genuinely do, you know, good deeds for the community. It's their way of, and what I like about it is I would rather these organizations do good things for the welfare of their fellow man than the government do it. The government can't sustain that.
True.
But these organizations are often made up of wealthy, successful men. And, you know, they're generous enough and philanthropical enough that, you know, they want to help the needy. And that's what these organizations. The Shriners Hospital is renowned for being a great hospital for children, and their burn center is legendary. So, you know, they do great things. Now, within an organization like that, just like within our everyday society or any, you know, any neighborhood in America, you're going to have some people that are interested in the more arcane aspects, and it, you know, therefore it serves that purpose for those who are interested in that.
That's what I'm interested in. Yeah, that's what seems to be most fascinating about it, because it seems like maybe the way it looks to me as an outsider and a bit of a conspiracy theorist is up until a certain point, it's about that business relationship. But then, you know, you'll have these guys who seek out those who are interested in that arcane, and they'll say, okay, you're ready to come up a level. You're up, you know, let's go behind this closed door. And
And if, you know, if you use basic common sense and logic, you can see how that would work. Is, mm-hmm. you know, you have a lodge and you have all the guys having their coffee cake and having some beers together, and they help the widows and orphans. And then you've got the guys higher up that are interested in this stuff, and they're watching and they're seeing, just like you spelled out, they would see, you know, who is more suited to this knowledge. And, yeah, they would be vetted and recruited into that knowledge in that way. That's logically how it would work.
And I guess another argument that a lot of conspiracy theorists would make is that almost that those lower levels are pawns to the higher levels, because they're creating the philanthropic front that covers up the real damage they're doing at a higher level in secrecy. And that's debatable, but
yeah, if you believe that these guys are the evil masterminds behind this stuff, here's one thing you have to remember. A lot of people in the public don't know this, but when you become a Mason, you learn that we have a thing where it's just part of our thing. We don't defend ourselves publicly. We mm-hmm. let people say whatever they want to say, and we do not defend ourselves publicly. No matter how heinous it is, in Masonry, you just let people who don't know, essentially don't know what they're talking about, run their mouths and say whatever they want, and you don't openly defend yourself, because throughout time, you know, Masonic lodges have had to go underground, and then they, you know, are public. We've been in a public phase for a while, mm-hmm. Greatly, you know, because, you know, here in the States, politically things were different, but, you know, over in the old world, in Europe, when you had the Vatican with all its power, you know, if you want to look at an organization that's being a mastermind behind certain things, as we know, we got to look at the Vatican also. And, mm-hmm. and it's legendary how much, you know, historically the church has hated Masonry. They used to excommunicate. Mm-hmm. If a Catholic man joined a lodge, he was excommunicated. So what a lot of people don't know is the material that a lot of our present-day conspiracies are based on, this is stuff that was made up out of whole cloth by the Vatican back in the 19th century just to slander Masonry.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that wasn't true, because they didn't want their males joining the lodges.
Yeah, you know, there doesn't seem to be anything innately wrong with, you know, knowing about archaic symbolism and ley lines, and principles of engineering that are inherent to the earth, you know, the sacred geometry kind of thing. Doesn't seem to be anything wrong with that necessarily, but I think where people get paranoid is that archaic symbolism is affecting, you know, you on a subconscious level, that you're getting into the realm of mind control almost. You're right on that line. At least that's the perception.
Well, there you go. There's a perception. And, you know, I was in a profession where, let me put it to you this way, a phrase that I absolutely despise that people love to use is perception is reality. Ha ha, bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, in my profession, perception was usually a mask created by somebody who was hiding something.
Yes.
And that's what I discovered, is perception isn't always reality, and people need to remind themselves that. But going back to perception of Masons, what if the application of these symbols, what if the manipulation of the public consciousness through the Masonic symbols and or the Masonic use of symbols, what if that wasn't so much a manipulation or a control as it was an enlightenment? What if the right. presence of symbols, when you walk around, you know, doing your daily business in a city that's full of these symbols, what if those are symbols that mean something to the subconscious and actually are keys to unlocking the subconscious and giving you more awareness? And this, I argue, and I'm not the only one, but this, I argue, is why organizations like the Vatican powers and other true tyrants are against Masonry, because they know that these things free the individual, and that's what they're scared of. We live in an era right now that preaches the collective, mm-hmm. and I'm telling you, that is dangerous. That's who you got to worry about, are the collectivists. Masonry has always been about the enlightenment of the individual. When you really dig into it and really know what you're talking about with Masonry, and when Freemasons put these things out in the public, it's not to control you, it's not to hypnotize you into a zombie state. It's quite the opposite. It is designed and it's intended to open your consciousness and make you more aware, and what that does is that sets you free, so to speak.
That's an interesting perspective, and I don't necessarily disagree with it, but I guess people would say, well, then why the secrecy? But then you'd have to say, well, because there's a lot of knowledge here, and if you don't know it, it's not going to benefit you.
I'll tell you why the secrecy. It's just the same reason why I quit talking about certain personal experiences in interviews and in my books. I realize why, and I don't want anyone to get offended, but this is the best phrase to put it. You know, you get tired of casting your pearls before swine. And what I mean by that is, you know, speaking for myself, I go down a certain path, I dig things out, I learn certain truths and facts, I have certain experiences. And like we were talking earlier, there's no way in hell that just my describing it to you, you're reading my words of my description of my experience, is going to convey the full a comprehensive impact of that experience. You've got to have the experience yourself. So therefore, the secrecy is more a camaraderie between actual experiencers who understand this. What I've come to learn is not everybody has a right to know mm-hmm. about all this,
yeah.
unless they go and earn it. They do have, it's there, it's out there for them to, they have a right to it, but they have to earn it. They don't have a right for somebody who else who has it to just give it to them. And I'm not about to, you know, just give things to people. I would rather see them earn it, dig it out themselves, because they'll get more out of it. It's better for them. And I think that's what part of the secrecy is about. The other part of the secrecy is a very practical thing. You have to remember, during times of tyranny, Masonic lodges are condemned. And so these guys have to operate under the surface, and that's how you know who's a true member or who is maybe an infiltrator, you know, from the mm-hmm. bad guys speak. So it has a practical application, and it's, you know, it's not as sinister as people think. It's sinister as hell to collectivist-minded people, of course, you know, because they don't like true individuality. So it scares the hell out of them.
Fair. Yeah, I mean, not to get on a whole another tangent, but it seems like there's also a collectivist move. There's both the people who are afraid of the New World Order and the One World Government, but then also, you know, I see that among the enlightened, there's also another movement that eventually we will have to evolve into, you know, a global society. When you see, at least in the stereotypical sci-fi way, beings from another planet, they've got to operate as a unit and get that all sorted out before they can really graduate to a place of real global prosperity. And I'd say there's probably something to that as well.
I see that. I have come to see that more as mythology. I see that as the wet dream of the people who are true globalists, and they want people who are suspicious of globalism to believe in that. Here's the way I see it. As technology allows, you're going to have people who think like me. They're going to say, no, this evils of collectivism, with globalism, with this global community comes some really bad things. No, thank you. We don't want to participate. And when the technology allows, just as people who think more freely got in ships and crossed oceans, these same kind of people are going to get in ships and cross the seas of space and just go to other worlds. I wish there was that opportunity now.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah, and so you're always going to have free thinkers who see the evils of globalism and see it for what it really is and understand why that's not such a peachy idea.
Right. Corruption is everywhere, and the concentration of power only makes it easier for corruption to get a serious foothold. But let's
There you go.
Let's bring this back to the book and Disneyland. We've talked about the masonry. We talked, you know, Walt Disney was not a Mason. So if there was some some knowledge there to be had to place Disney in Anaheim on the cross section of these ley lines for a reason, where did this knowledge come from if it didn't come from Walt Disney?
Well, as the book goes into and introduces the reader, there was a gentleman named C.V. Wood who was an engineer for the Stanford Research Institute, the legendary SRI, who was involved in a lot of interesting technology in the mid-20th century. And scientific remote viewing is the biggest one. The people are familiar with the stories of the unit that involved that employed Joseph McMonagall and all those guys who are able to essentially remote viewing is when you can open up your consciousness and describe places that are miles away from your position, thus remote viewing. And certain guys, researchers at SRI, were involved in the creation and development of the protocols that are used in this remote viewing concept. And that's probably what they're presently most famous for as far as what we would call paranormal. There was a gentleman working there in the 50s, C.V. Wood, who was very interested in psychic phenomena and such things like that. And along came the Disney brothers, who came to SRI for much more mundane consultation regarding where to place their amusement park. And various locations were considered, but the location in Anaheim was finalized, and C.V. Wood was most involved with that. In fact, C.V. Wood was so enamored of the idea of Disneyland that he left SRI to go work for Walt and Roy as the main engineer building Disneyland. C.V. Wood was the head engineer on the building of the park. So to go to Disneyland, the physical layout and such, that was all C.V. Wood. He's the one who came up with that, and so therefore, as the book details, he's the one who placed the carousel on the intersection of ley lines. He's the one who shaped the park physically, placed it, he dug a burrow out of the earth and such. So all the things talked about in the book, as far as Disneyland being a psychotronic device, that can be credited to C.V. Wood.
Yeah, and now this is where we're really getting into it, because, you know, most people don't know it was built in a bowl type layout. And we talked about the Nazi bell, we've talked about the harmonics and the energies of these ley lines, and it seems like your hypothesis is that the carousel itself is a spinning metal device located on the cross-section of these ley lines in its bowl. This is almost creating an energy bubble, or at least that's the theory, correct?
Right, yeah, it doesn't have to be metal, by the way. In the case of it just is a rotating device. You place it in conjunction with that lay energy, and you know theoretically you're going to get these results. You're going to get something that you know it's more than the sum of its parts. And the carousel was placed on the intersection of the three ley lines that are in Fantasyland, and the rotation of the carousel draws up the energy from these three lines, which is already three times more powerful than if it had been just on a single line. And it draws it up, but then also the rotation, the spin, then disperses it throughout the park. It spreads that energy throughout the park, and because the park is dug into a bowl, the energy spreads out, and as it flows out towards the berm of the bowl, it kind of has that effect where then it rolls back in on itself. So it does create this bowl of energy that is, you know, contained right there in the park.
And this energy, what would you say the effects of this energy could be? And they seem to be, at least I've been to Disneyland recently, and of course, this effect is no longer in place.
Right. I believe the device was disengaged in 1982 when they redesigned Fantasyland because they moved the carousel several feet. So the device has been disengaged, and that I attribute to why the park is really in some ways a shadow of its former self. Mm-hmm. There's several people that young folks who never got to experience Disneyland prior to 1982, and I tell you, they have not truly experienced what the device did. You would go to Disneyland, and it was like going to Vegas, where there's no windows in the casinos and there's no clocks, if you'll notice. They mm-hmm. they don't want you to know what, they just want you to get lost in the experience and stay in there all day.
Right.
The Disneyland was a very similar experience. You'd go in there and you would literally forget that you were in the middle of Anaheim, California. And you would just get lost in this world and just, you know, having fun. I mean, you knew you were in an amusement park, but
right.
it was not quite like any other. And I theorize, I present the idea in the book, the evidence, that was a result, and that was the intended result, I'm convinced, of this device, was just to enhance the personal experience of being at the park,
mm-hmm.
a totally benign goal, objective. And so at the very least, you've got that as the reason why this was built and what its intention was. Now, on the other end, depending upon how receptive you are as an individual, psychically and such, the experience can be quite esoteric, so to speak. It can manifest things beyond just a good feeling, as I experienced, and the book goes into greater detail on.
And is there, besides your personal experience, is there a rich history of that type of thing occurring at Disneyland?
Well, we know that there are stories of ghosts, and as the book puts it, you know, and you mentioned earlier, these things, places could be doorways, maybe, you know, that it opens
mm-hmm.
doorways, this technology. Now, after my book got out there, I had some people contact me, indeed saying that they had some similar experiences. And, you know, in talking with these people, you know, you can pick out the ones that are just bandwagoners and the ones that are, you know, sincerely, you know, have had these experiences. So yes, I would say based
mm-hmm.
on that, there are people that have been having experiences. And again, the cutoff is 1982. With the device disengaged in 82, what I'm talking about, you know, it's
kind of
past. It can't happen.
Right.
You know? Now,
today
they did
it's just
it on...
pure capitalism. It is a soulless place. It's just a
you're right.
Thin gloss
I
of paint.
I'm a capitalist myself. I don't think business is evil, but I do mm-hmm. think that they, you know, what they've done is every new attraction has to be tied in with a product. You know, Walt didn't always do that. In the old days at Disneyland, not every attraction, it might have been tied into a sponsor, but that's how he got the place built. See, people
mm-hmm.
don't realize that, you know, some people that would be critics of the place, they would go to Disneyland in the old days, and it was the General Electric Carousel of Progress. Well, it wasn't just, you know, hey, let's build something to sell GE appliances. Walt and Roy, and this was C.B. Wood's idea, by the way,
mm-hmm.
He got Walt and Roy to go to General Electric and say, we need X number of dollars to build this really cool attraction. And GE said, oh, okay, that's cool. And the Disney said, and you can put your company name on it. We don't care. And you can showcase your future technology. Same with Atlantic Richfield, which we now know as ARCO. They went to them and said, look, we want to build this thing called Autopia. It's a fun car ride. And you know, would you guys pay for that attraction? And they said, yeah, we'll invest in that attraction, sure. And you can put your name on it. So it was the Richfield, sponsored Autopia. So this was not an evil, sinister you know, conspiratorial thing they were doing with these companies. But so to me, that's the positive example of, you know, that was not an evil capitalist thing. That was a good capitalist thing in that case. But I totally agree with you. Now, you know, everything in there has to be, you know, pushing some product. Right. For instance, a marine voyage, they didn't need to make that the Finding Nemo ride. Walt didn't have the submarine voyage tied to any of his movies, and he could have had it tied to 20,000 Leagues like it was at Disney World, but he didn't. But, you know, the guys in, you know, in control in recent years, it has to be, it's got to be selling and pushing something, and you can see it and you can feel it in the park that it's just not what it used to be, and it's way too expensive to be worth going. And then they're ruining the park.
I agree that it is not, it doesn't seem special. You know, there is a tendency for people to remember the good old days, but I think that really does apply to Disneyland. And I guess you would suggest it was the moving of this device, the carousel, from the ley lines that maybe, you know, put it on that path of losing its magic.
Yeah, see, the whole park is the device itself, and the carousel is the operative piece that makes it all work. And if they, I argue that if they moved the carousel back to its original position, that the device would become operative again.
It might start affecting the consciousness in a more, I guess, slightly euphoric, more positive way, more enlightening way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. C.B. Wood did this for positive reasons, I'm convinced. And this is a good thing. My experience is, you know, people can read in the book. I see that as it was totally a good thing. It was an amazing thing. And this was not to, you know, mind screw anybody or turn people into slaves. That's ridiculous. I mean, think about it. That wouldn't have served any purpose. I mean, Walt Disney was an entertainer. He was a showman. He wanted people to enjoy his park and come back again and again. And you know what? Yeah, maybe he wanted them to be in the mood to buy more popcorn and get a T-shirt or a stuffed animal or something, buy more tickets, buy more rides. You know what? We live in a time where everybody wants to demonize business, and I reject that. I reject that. That is absolutely ridiculous. And so, you know, there's nothing evil about what Walt Disney did. I'll tell you what, the so-called dark side of Walt Disney, he smoked like a chimney. You know, he liked to drink a little, and they say he cussed like a sailor. Okay, oh gosh, you know, what a rotten guy.
I did want to ask you about alchemy and symbolism as it pertains to Disney, because we're really, that's really two distinct topics, because you got Walt Disney and his vision of the company, and then you got the modern Disney Corporation. And when most people hear Disney conspiracy or symbolism, they think of the Little Mermaid cock castle, whispers of take off your clothes in Aladdin, stuff like that. And I've got a big interest in those more modern hidden messages and what type of effect, if any, they could really be having. You know,
in my opinion, I've looked at those situations, and I found that, you know, I've separated the wheat from the chaff, the stuff that's not true from what is true. And what I've found in convincingly is that the people that have done that have been, you know, disgruntled employees or smart-ass employees who thought it would be cute because of personal issues with the company. I don't think the guys that, you know, that have been doing the more negative aspects of running the company, I don't think they're, when I say not smart enough to do some big sinister thing, it's because I don't think they're the kind that care about these esoteric things and are aware of this.
I haven't been tuned in.
It's just greed and a particular outlook on what, you know, commerce is supposed to be in their minds. And it's,
but even,
you know, I don't think there's anything sinister to that. Now, that said, as the book states, I do think that C.V. Wood was somebody who was very much into this stuff. And that's why you find the symbolism around the park. And I'm glad you brought that up, because the book goes into that. The book goes into alchemical symbols that are all over the park, particularly the carousel and fantasy.
Detail some of that for us, if you can remember.
Oh gosh, yeah. Well, you've got the symbols of, like, the keys on the shields that decorate the carousel overhang cover thing. You know, you've got the keys, which are a chemical symbol, you know, for, like I said, it's been a few years since I wrote it. Forgive me.
Well, the symbol that I thought was most interesting was the one that we use today to represent, medical things with the two snakes swirling around
the caduceus.
The center pole.
And that energy. And you know, it's interesting you bring that up because that symbol came from the ancient East Indian information where the same ancient writings where the Nazi scientists got their information on building the bell. And that the snakes represent the energy spinning around, you know, the central pole, which allowed flight of these ancient vimanas.
Almost a representation of a carousel, really.
Exactly. There's that. And then there's the whole thing about the four treasures of the Tuatha de Danaans. And if I'm pronouncing that properly, I go into that in the book where, you know, the crown, the scepter, and the sword and the other things. And that is right there, you know, associated with the carousel and around the park. And when you get into the fairy tales, the symbolism of the, you know, the actual fairy tales, I think everybody by now is aware that the, you know, our modern day, you know, particularly the stories that Disney turned into films had much darker beginnings and origins.
Only darker, but they also seem to be less removed from reality. There seemed to be a little more of a tie to reality in that some of these things like fairies and gnomes and whatnot were beings, cryptozoology beings almost, beings from a parallel universe, parallel dimension.
Or, yeah, absolutely, particularly in the case, some say, of the Tuatha and the Fomorai, you know, they disappeared into, you know, another either the underground world or another dimension, sure, you know, or maybe into space or whatever. That's really wild stuff that I think is totally cool, that involved in the symbolism you find around the park and fairy tales in general. One of my favorite things was when I mentioned in the book that the gnomes, the famous gnomes with the red conical hats, how those hats actually start out white. And people don't realize that they put these things in their gardens and they put them on commercials for travel, you know, companies and cute little gnomes. But those red hats start white and they turn red because they're dyed red with the blood of virgins that the gnomes drink out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a dark,
you know,
dark little tidbit.
So next time you see a garden gnome or you see that commercial on TV, you'll think of that. And, you know, so that's just one example of... you know, so these darker aspects we're talking about, but, you know, darker in the sense that it's not all evil from Satan. It's just darker in that most people aren't consciously aware of these things and it's scary to them because with that knowledge comes enlightenment that you can't always control and that is a tremendous responsibility once you have it. Once you're consciously aware of things, you can walk around in a place like Disneyland and just see it all over the place. Whereas other people that aren't aware of it, you know, they're like, huh, what? That just looks like a decoration on the wall to them. And if
it's
they
the
don't,
code.
Yeah, if they're not aware of what it means. And then of course, some people go, quite frankly, they go apeshit in the wrong direction. Once they learn that something has a second, a meaning to it, or they simply learn the meaning of something, they go crazy and think, oh my gosh, the overlords are doing this to, you know, drive us into the new world order. And it's okay, you know, personally, I've kind of had enough of that, but, cause you know, these things don't ever pan out the way the Chicken Littles say they're going to, but,
not yet.
It's interesting. And C.V. Wood, I believe, built Disneyland to be a psychotronic device, in effect, that would simply, if it didn't open people's minds consciously, it would give them, you know, it would enhance their good time at a fun place. That's what I really, truly have found his objective to be.
Yeah, an altruistic motive. And I definitely could see that being possible. And whether these more modern problems in Disney movies or these little subtle messages, whether they're disgruntled employees or not, none of this came about until the death of Walt Disney anyway. So
that's right. And thank you for bringing that up. That stuff didn't happen while Walt was alive.
You can't put that on him.
Yeah, they can't. In fact, I've been very critical of the Disney company in recent times, but I make the distinction, the big fat line between the era when Walt was alive and mm-hmm. after the family members lost control of the company. I blame it on it's the Michael Eisner era is when it started.
And he became CEO around what time?
In the 80s, I think. Yeah, and late 80s or something. It was really all the nasty stuff, all the bad stuff that you can honestly say about the Disney company really started and went through mostly the Michael Eisner era. I mean, he's the guy that had the reins that, has made the park way more expensive than Walt ever envisioned. He's the guy running the show when, you know, that here's the thing. You got to understand. How old are you, Greg?
I'm 27.
You're 27. You're a youngster. I'm 49, yeah. Okay? Guys like me and Adam, we remember what Disneyland used to be. And you would go to that park, and once it got fully up to speed, you'd go to that park, and there was never a dead zone in Disneyland. Every corner you went to, there was something there, and it was well maintained, and it was just a pleasant, quiet little back corner where the little motorboat rides used to be. It was always well maintained. It was cleaned, and in recent years, Tomorrowland, and I talk about this a little bit in the book. Tomorrowland has become like the back room in your grandma's house, where just crap is stored and nobody mm-hmm. goes in there.
I see that everywhere.
And you go to Disneyland now, and I actually see rails that have grime built up on
yep.
them and paint chipped off. I got to tell you, Greg, never, never was Disneyland ever like that. They would every night clean that place, and if paint was chipped, it was fixed within 12 hours. I mean, you just never saw that. And in the Eisner era, the emphasis was not put on the parks. It was like, to hell with it, you know, and let's crank up the ticket price and people will still flock. And and they do, you know, but it's way too crowded. It's
yes.
way too expensive. And it's just not up to par what it
it's
used
sad.
To be.
It's sad. Yeah.
You know.
It's sad that that I'll never really be able to experience that. But I guess, to support my conspiratorial and anti-capitalistic view, I would argue that the wrong side of business, the wrong type of capitalist, always gets a hold of something and ruins it. And this is a prime example.
They often do, let's say.
Often, but the problem is that whether it happens gradually over time or rapidly, it never goes back to the way it was. And so you got 500 major companies over the past, 100 years slowly getting taken over by the wrong type of capitalist. And then you have a situation where, like we do today, where the control is out of control. You know, it's way overboard. And you don't see anyone come along and clean them out. They only clean out the good guy.
Well,
at least that's
we
my
live
argument.
In an era where visionaries are demonized.
That's
Disney
true.
Was a visionary, and we live in a society where we can't have visionaries, and that's the collectivists are scared to death of the individual who is truly a visionary, because that individual can do amazing things that does not serve the collective.
Right. Just go man a cash register and shut the fuck up, you know? That's
yeah,
the approach today.
You know, exactly. And so the visionary, look what's done to Walt Disney. People have to demonize him, and I would argue that the people who demonize him are the ones who basically lack vision and are jealous of people like that. And I mean, we see that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people that are they stand tall above the crowd, and that's the first blade of grass that has to get mowed down by the
Sour
jealous mediocre. Ayn Rand wrote about it in Atlas Shrugged,
right?
And in her other works, you know, it's. George Orwell wrote about it when, you know, I think it's 1984, where, you know, people are forced to wear, you know, people with good vision are forced to wear glasses that, you know, bring their vision down to be, you know, everybody's forced to be mediocre because, mm-hmm. God forbid, we hurt someone's feelings. All this, you know, let's level the playing field, let's make everybody feel good, is seriously damaging human civilization because it's wussifying and wimpifying humankind. And let me tell you, that is every bit as sinister as anything a corporate guy's doing, because the goal of it is to turn everything into a big global new world order where everybody's more easily controlled because, you know, the people who stand out will be afraid to stand out, or if they do, you know, their head gets chopped off. You know, here's my general view. I find utopian thinking quaint and kind of childish. This reality we live in, this world we live in, it is exactly what it is supposed to be. Okay, we were never intended to make this a 100% fair and peaceful and wonderful world, this utopia. All we can do, as far as that's concerned, is change ourselves. All we can do is work on ourselves. If we work on ourselves, then our environment, I say our social environment, our national environment, our global environment will be better. But too many people want to think that they can make this reality we live in a utopia. And I argue it already is exactly what it's supposed to be. And that is when it's tough, when it's harsh, when bad things pop up, it's because that's supposed to test our individual character, see?
And that's a
so,
fair point.
Rather than try to change the world, which I might add, you're never going to do. It is a waste of time.
But a visionary might say otherwise.
Well, yeah, but, you know, okay.
I'm just messing with you, but, and there does seem
remember,
to be
Remember, I didn't say you always have to agree with the visionary. What I'm saying is we tend to demonize visionaries.
Right. But a true visionary would probably hope for and strive for that utopia.
And some good things come from that, but remember, people in hell want ice water. There's just some things that aren't going to happen, and I think you have to be practical. And even we're talking about Walt Disney. I think he was a practical visionary. Okay, and what I mean by practical was his vision. You know, he's like, well, I can buy 160 acres over here in Anaheim and build my little amusement park, and people can come enjoy the practical application of my vision for a day.
Yeah.
And what they take from that, you know, and if you put that out on the macrocosm, you know. People can come away from their exposure to the visionary's practical application of their ideal and come away with something that changes them so that they become, you know, a better person inside, a better citizen
yes.
of their community, or a better citizen of the world. But that doesn't mean we have to force everybody to get into lockstep.
Now, that's true.
With that. And
I don't agree with the forcing, but there does seem to be a duality to almost everything. I think it's kind of built in, but there, you know, you have people in the same camp with the same philosophy saying, you know, we are all one, which is a nice idea. And then they also say true change comes from within. So, you know, you're talking about you need to work on yourself on an individual level and it will radiate out, which is a popular idea and one that I'd probably agree with. But then also, you know, we are all one.
People aren't going to change the world by going out there to change the world.
Right.
People will change the world by changing themselves and then being an example to others.
The only thing I don't like about the, you know, some libertarian or conservative or individual approach is it just seems, while it does seem to be the most free, the most freeing, but it also seems a bit cold, and that's the angle that that bothers me about it. That's the chip on my shoulder.
That be conditioning? Could that be that, you know, you
could
merely to believe that?
That definitely could. There's many layers to this manipulation, and I'm not immune to any of them. But I'm constantly trying to figure out where the line is drawn, and I don't deny that it could be manipulation from my young,
and
impressionable stoner mind.
Maybe what you're interpreting as cold is actually just really a faith in your ability to handle something that you think, you know, and I'm speaking, you know, in examples
Fair.
Here, speaking hypothetically, you got a situation where, oh my gosh, I'm overwhelmed, blah, blah, blah. And an individualist would say, well,
overcome.
You know, I'll give you a hand to get your butt up back on your feet and press on. Why? Because I have the faith that you have the wherewithal inside you to be able to solve this problem and get through it. And where you need a hand, I'll give you a hand. But the individualist, the libertarian, says, you know, hey, I'll help you up, but I'm not going to carry you the whole way because it's not good for you. You will get so much more out of your struggles. And this goes back to why I think the world is exactly what it's supposed to be. What you get out of you, see, here's the deal. Here's the conditioning that is wrong in our times,
mm-hmm.
is the idea that the world is supposed to be fair, that we can engineer a world, an environment, a society where, you know, oh, there is no struggle. Well, what a bunch of damn fools. I mean, the struggle is part of human existence. It's part of how you advance your soul. It's part of how you become a whole being and experience the fullness of what life is.
I do see that struggle creates strength, and it's almost a necessary part of that strength creation. But this pull yourself up by your bootstraps attitude is being preached by a corporatocracy that is at the very same time undermining our ability to do that with lower wages, stealing pensions. So it's all empty in a way in today's world. At least that's my view of it.
I would argue that's your conditioning, because there are, you know, governments who claim to be helping those very same victims. They're not doing anything better by making welfare and the dependency state more easily available. People just say, well, why should I bust my ass to improve my lot when I can get up to the equivalent of $40,000 a year on food stamps and all this other stuff? I'll just kick back and, you know, collect my stuff from the government, and they don't advance that way either. So here's the thing: both sides do nefarious things, right?
Right.
And
Agreed.
It's hard for some people to know what's the good guys, what's the bad guys. And I argue that there's bad on both sides. And that's
also
why
agree.
It comes to the individual. If you want to really know what's going on, if you want to be able to see the good guys and the bad guys and see who's doing the nefarious stuff, you owe it to yourself to enlighten yourself. And that's why, bringing it back to this, the more time you spend enlightening yourself on that esoteric level, the more you're going to be able to see things for what they are. And believe me, I have my things that I'm critical about in the capitalist world, but here's what life has convinced me of: that, like it or not, for all its imperfections, the free market and commerce and trade, these things that are in capitalism,
mm-hmm.
these have been far better for humanity on the good things than the other way has ever been. And if you really look at history, honest history, you'll see that's true. Now, does that mean, you know, people take advantage of it? Of course they do. This is why we have, you know, laws, and this is why we have punishments. And, you know, when somebody breaks the rules, you punish them for breaking the rules, but you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, you go to a hospital, right? A hospital does great things. Well, you have a couple of doctors there that are doing rotten things. You don't outlaw hospitals just because a couple of rotten doctors. You take the license away from those doctors and you never let them practice medicine again. But you don't close the hospital down.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
People see the evils. They see some bad eggs doing stuff in business, so they want to shut down capitalism. They want to tear it all down. Well, that's foolish, to put it in a word. And this is all part of the Enlightenment thing. You know, you get out there. You start looking for the big truths and understanding, you know, these esoteric things, and the everyday things will even become more clear to you. And that's really why I espouse the path of individual enlightenment, because each person owes it to themselves. You're shortchanging yourself if you don't pursue this. And, you know, the fact that, you know, like you're willing, you know, you're asking me, hey, where can I go to, you know, that's the first step. You're someone who's smart enough and realize, hey, you know, I want some of that. I want to know this stuff. And I'm glad to tell you, hey, go here, go there, you know, be open to it, ready for it, but be open to it, because it's there for the taking, and you owe it to yourself to do it, you know. And you may not come away with the same exact spin, you know, that I do, and that's okay.
Right.
That's okay.
Well, hey, you know, we're getting towards the end of the show here. I mean, it's been a fascinating conversation. You know, I've always been interested in some of the mechanisms or the tools that create situations of power, which you could say this might fall into that category, even though it wasn't an evil thing. It definitely probably contributed to the success of Disneyland. And it's just it's a really interesting topic I really hadn't heard discussed anywhere else. I'm glad you wrote the book. And I'm glad you came on the show today.
Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate, you know, getting the chance to talk about it. And I hope we didn't meander off topic too much. But, you know, it's a very interesting book. And I think your listeners will enjoy it. And it's cheap, too.
Yeah, I absolutely encourage anyone to get it. There's a Kindle version, which definitely cuts down on costs and, you know, makes it a little easier to get. But let people know before we go, what other projects are you working on? What do you got going on now in the future?
Well, if they like, I would recommend they start with the Disneyland book before they would read the other book that I published last year called titled Empire of the Wheel, which was a result of, after doing the Disneyland book, I wanted to research the ley lines that intersect in Disneyland and spread out through Southern California, and that led me to the information in Empire of the Wheel, which is a much darker, bigger book.
Mm-hmm.
I am researching what could be the second book, but I'm not sure yet if I'm going to write that, because I'm discovering things I'm not sure I want to share, and so I'm kind of neck deep in that research. I'm also making a film. I did a film titled Hell's Bells, a 46-minute silent short, which should be available on Amazon streaming very soon, and of course a DVD.
Nice.
I'm in the middle of putting together the DVD for that. Again, it's titled Hell's Bells. It's a silent movie set in 1929, kind of a comic horror film.
Nice.
And presently I'm shooting a horror film called titled Cathonic, which is a sound film, a feature length. This one will be about 90 minutes. And it is very much, if you like the topics we talked about today or didn't get to in great detail, the alchemical and the esoteric and arcane stuff, it's a film about that. And identity, personal identity, in some cases gender identity, trans, some kind of thing. So just doing that, that's what I'm up to.
Very awesome. Well, Walter, it was a real pleasure. You know, great chat. Hopefully someday we can get together again, maybe talk about Empire of the Wheel, get a little deeper into it.
Well, maybe I can go down to, I'm down in San Diego a lot. I could probably show you some spots sometime too. So.
Absolutely. Definitely. Would love to see that happen. You know, well, let me know when you're down here. Hope we can talk again. I know you got many more interesting works and life stories we didn't get to bring up, but you got any last words for the people?
You know, just get out there and, you know, rather than read, I know I just said read my book, and I want you to read my book, but remember, ultimately, you know, after you read the books, I strongly recommend people just get out there and find out things for themselves. That's
right.
Ultimately where you're going to learn the most. The books are a good pointer, but after that, take it from there and go on your own adventures.
All right. Walter Bosley, the Boz, you're the man. Thanks again.
Thank you, Greg.
There you have it, folks. Thanks again for making THC what it is, and it means so much that you're listening. I've seen a lot more sharing of the show. iTunes reviews have been helpful. Stitcher favorites, all great stuff. And we're growing all the time. And we're trying to make conspiracy and the paranormal and the weird interesting and fun, and not some boring, low-quality lecture series on YouTube or a bunch of new agey bullshit. So I'm going to keep doing what I can, and I cannot wait to introduce you to some of the new members of the team, and we will have them co-hosting shows with me soon. 2013 is the year of THC in so many ways, and with that, check out Latitude 33. It's an awesome book, and see if you can find a shirt at conspiracies.net that you like enough to buy, and I would love to send that out to you. And I'll see you next week, and I mean next week.
I put a spell on you. Because you're my